Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Charges filed against the Baltimore police. The chief prosecutor for the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore has announced criminal charges against six police officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray.
The findings of our comprehensive, thorough, and independent investigation, coupled with the medical examiner's determination that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide, which we received today, has led us to believe that we have probable cause to file criminal charges.
State medical examiner has determined his death in police custody was a homicide. State's attorney Marilyn Mosby said Friday Gray suffered a severe and critical neck injury while being transported in the police van April 12th. They include second-degree murder against one of the officers, as well as involuntary manslaughter, second-degree assault, misconduct in office, and false imprisonment. President Obama said those individuals who are charged obviously are also entitled to due process and rule of law. Friday's announcement of charges against the six police officers comes amid a widespread outcry over Gray's death, the latest instance of alleged police violence against black males that has sparked protests and calls for justice across the country. Nepal is still coming to grips with the full extent of the devastation and misery caused by last Saturday's magnitude 7.8 earthquake. Some of the hardest-hit communities have been cut off by landslides. A VOA news crew has been among the first to reach a few of the smaller remote communities. Correspondent Steve Herman has that report from Nepal. You are listening to The Voice of America.
The small fishing village of Maji Gong on the banks of the Indrawati River exists on few maps. Now it has been wiped off the map. All 50 stone and wood homes tumbled in an instant when the quake shattered Nepal. To reach Maji Gong, a VOA news crew drove for hours over roads just cleared of landslides and then hiked down a steep path on a terraced paddy field. Five people died here. One teenage boy is missing, and about 20 villagers were injured. Steve Herman, VOA News, Sindhu Polchak, Nepal.
Saudi Arabia says it has killed dozens of Yemeni Shiite rebels who were carrying out a large-scale cross-border attack on the kingdom. In a statement, Riyadh's defense ministry said three Saudi soldiers were killed in the late Thursday fighting in southern Najran province. The ministry says the rebels attacked border posts and control points. They were repelled by a combination of Saudi ground troops and airstrikes. It is believed to be the largest cross-border attack by the rebels since a Saudi-led coalition began a campaign of airstrikes against them 5 weeks ago. On the topic of Saudi world order, in the current world order, relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia are often viewed as a zero-sum game. If one is thought to be gaining influence, it's assumed the other must be losing it. True or not, it appears that Saudi Arabia is shaking up its leadership, ensuring a clear line of succession with younger, more aggressive men hoping to expand Saudi Arabia's regional power as the king nears his 80th birthday. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from Cairo.
As Gulf leaders arrived in the Saudi capital, Riyadh, on Thursday to prepare for an upcoming summit in the United States, all eyes were on the Saudi royal family. The aging king has named new, younger successors and replaced the longest-serving foreign minister anywhere, 75-year-old Saud Al-Faisal. Theodore Karasik, a Gulf-based geopolitical analyst and senior advisor to Gulf State Analytics, says this is a sign of a new era in Saudi policymaking, both foreign and domestic.
The new Saudi leadership, as it begins to rise to the throne and makes policy, this is going to be more robust, vocal, and full of action.
Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
Most Americans support drone strikes against terrorists, including when a known terrorist is an American, according to a new public opinion poll. An Associated Press poll found nearly three-quarters of Americans say it is acceptable for the U.S. to use an unmanned aerial drone to kill an American citizen abroad if that person has joined a terror organization. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
UN aid agencies warn the growing standoff between protesters and the Burundian government over upcoming presidential elections is raising fears of the country descending into chaos and possible civil war. The UN Human Rights Office is expressing serious concern about the situation in the country.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. We'll have full details coming up. Also, Rwanda is hosting more than 20,000 Burundians who fled their country this week. The discovery of four mass graves in Beni territory in eastern Congo raises questions about the fate of nearly 1,000 people abducted by Ugandan Islamist ADF rebels. And residents of islands on Lake Chad are being evacuated following a deadly failed attack on Karamga Island last week by Boko Haram militants. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Burundi's president is warning of a tough response to demonstrations this week protesting his seeking a third term in office. Reuters reports that President Pierre Nkurunziza has announced he set up a judiciary committee to investigate the protest, which he calls an insurrectional movement. The Burundian leader says findings will be released within 1 month, adding that severe sanctions will be taken against those found guilty. Protesters say the president has violated the constitution by seeking a third term. However, the ruling party says his first term was a result of members of parliament choosing and not voters. In related news, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, Tom Malinowski, has met with President Nkurunziza. After the meeting, he told reporters that the U.S. government has serious concerns about the situation. He says it is important to allow space in Burundi for opposition, for press, and for civil society to express whatever views they have peacefully so that the democratic process going forward can be legitimate. He says he told the president that Burundi is like a boiling pot that won't stop boiling if you try to put a lid on it. The State Department official says the U.S. believes that if the president seeks a third term, it is a violation of the Arusha Peace Accord. Meanwhile, UN aid agencies warn the growing standoff between protesters and the Burundian government over upcoming presidential elections is raising fears of the country descending into chaos and possible civil war. The UN Human Rights Office is expressing serious concern about the situation in the country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says it is worried about increasingly repressive measures being taken by Burundi's government to stifle political dissent. Human Rights Office spokesman Rupert Colville points to a series of measures taken by Burundian authorities, which he says seriously curtail people's rights to freedom of peaceful expression and assembly.
Hundreds of people have also allegedly been detained since the demonstrations began last Sunday. And according to one credible report, over 400 individuals are being held in extremely overcrowded conditions, with detainees actually having to sleep standing up. It's so crowded. Detainees have also been beaten, allegedly, particularly on their feet and buttocks. And some of those who've been released have had trouble walking as a result of those beatings.
The International Red Cross reports at least six people have been killed in demonstrations following President Pierre Nkurunziza's announcement last week that he is planning to run for another term. Opponents say this is unconstitutional and violates the 2000 Arusha Agreement, which limits presidents in Burundi to two terms. Colville says High Commissioner Zeid Rad Al Hussein, at the end of his visit to Burundi a couple of weeks ago, essentially issued an early warning about the dangers of inflaming tensions as the elections approach. He tells VOA the High Commissioner was particularly concerned about the militia wing of the ruling party's Imbonerakure youth group.
The activities of that militia have been leading, according to refugees in Rwanda, arriving in Rwanda, one of the principal reasons why they've been fleeing across the border. So, you know, you've already got a refugee movement taking place. You've got a country with a terrible history. At the time we were there anyway, the ethnic element was not really an issue. But, one doesn't have to be a rocket scientist to say it could come one again, and that would be too awful for words.
More than 300,000 people died in Burundi's decade-long civil war between 1995 and 2005. The latest update by the UN Refugee Agency finds more than 26,000 people have fled Burundi because of violence linked to the elections. It says Rwanda is hosting more than 21,000 refugees, and thousands of others are heading for Tanzania and Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. Rwanda is hosting more than 20,000 Burundians who fled their country this week. Mohamed Yusuf visited one refugee camp in eastern Rwanda.
A group of Burundian refugees at a reception camp in Rwanda talk of their challenges and the circumstances in which they will go back. One woman says she fled to the bushes. When the violence erupted, I ran to the bush, she says. I was spending much of the time in the bush, and in the bush there was too much mosquitoes. See how my skin have turned red because of that mosquito bites. Another refugee, Ingeraneza Falaha, says armed men took all their belongings and left them with nothing. Before we got to the border, armed militiamen allied to the government beat us up, took all our clothes and little money we had, and left us to continue with our journey with nothing. She says, some of us were half naked. We got here with nothing. Here, a group of refugees started shouting at a woman who said her husband was fine back in Burundi, despite her being in the camp seeking refuge. Another refugee is 35-year-old Manirikeza Girogeri, who has visible bruises on his right arm and lower lip. He says he was beaten by armed men on his way to the Rwandan border. Four armed men captured me and shoved me to the ground and started beating me up in my arm and kicked me in my mouth, he says. Then I started crying loud so that I can get help. All the people on the road ran away. They continued to beat me and left me there. This reception center hosts more than 10,000 refugees. At least 2,000 per day are relocated to different camps set up by the Rwandan government to shelter the refugees. Bujesera Gashora reception camp manager Karagwa Azaria says the centre cannot hold such a large number of refugees.
Each camp must have some challenges because this is not a hotel where people have booked places, because one day we receive 3,000 persons and shelters was not according to that big number. So we are following the number, but number are not following shelters. That is the challenge. But we try to do our best.
26-year-old Nduwaye Azalia says he will not return home until President Nkurunziza steps down. If he continues contesting for the presidency, we refugees, we won't go back home, Azalia says. When he says, I am no longer vying for the seat for the third term, and he pulls all his armed militiamen in our villages and in the streets, we will go back home. Meanwhile, most of these Burundians wait to be transferred to another camp where an uncertain future awaits them. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Gashora, Rwanda.
14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, the discovery of four mass graves in Beni territory in eastern Congo has raised questions about the fate of nearly 1,000 people abducted by Ugandan Islamist ADF rebels. Reporter Nick Long visited Beni, where he interviewed several people who had escaped from the ADF.
Congolese army spokesman Major Victor Masandi said the four graves found during the weekend after the army captured an ADF camp contained the bodies of many people the ADF had executed, including hostages and dependents unable to flee. He reminded reporters that similar mass graves had been found after other ADF camps were captured. Many ADF hostages or kidnapped victims are unaccounted for. A civil society group in Beni told VOA it documented 947 people kidnapped by the ADF between 2010 and 2013. The group says 350 were reunited with their families between March and May 2014, but the fate of the others is unknown. Sadiki Mutamo, a Muslim farmer, was kidnapped by the ADF and held for a month in 2013. He says the ADF took him because he told them a lie. A group of them asked him if he had any goats. He said no, but his wife, who was afraid, said yes, they did have some goats. So they took him away because, as he puts it, the Muslims are against lying. When he arrived at the ADF camp, says Mutamo, he was stripped and put in a hole in the ground where there were 75 people. He says they spent the nights in that hole, and during the day, when they were hungry, they were allowed out to work and were fed and were then sent back to the hole. A lot of people in that hole died, he said, while others were freed. He says we knew they had died because when the ADF came to take them away, that was the last time we saw them. Mutamo was lucky. He was freed by a guard who noticed he was a Muslim because he has a mark on his forehead where he touches the ground when praying. Mutamo says the guard said to him, "How come you're a Muslim? Tomorrow you're going to die. For the sake of our religion, I'll let you escape, but don't let the other ADF see you." Kahamba Lusenge Georgine was kidnapped by the ADF and lived with them for more than a year. The ADF killed her parents and her husband. She spent 6 days in a hole without eating anything except earth, but was spared because one of the ADF fighters wanted her as his wife. She cries as she remembers how the ADF killed people. When they were killing people, they called us, she says, and we were allowed to lift our veils a few centimetres so that we could see the killing. And after they killed each person, we were allowed to applaud. At other times, she explained, they were not allowed to look up at ADF combatants. The ADF took their time over killing people, she says. They would torture them first, then read to them from their Bible or Quran, and then they would finish them off. VOA spoke to another ADF kidnapped victim who was abducted when she was five. She had been an ADF combatant and asked for her identity to be withheld. She described how the ADF would execute people slowly, cutting off noses and gouging out eyes before finishing off their victims. She said the ADF commander killed by the DRC army at the weekend, Kasada Kalume, trained combatants in how to execute people. DRC Army spokesman Major Victor Masandi says the army is calling for an investigation of the graves and is more than ever determined to wipe out the ADF. A spokesman for the Muslim community in Beni told VOA that his community has no links with the ADF and he believes the movement has no more to do with Islam than the Lord's Resistance Army has to do with Christianity. Nick Long for VOA News, Beni, DRC.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Residents of islands on Lake Chad are being evacuated following a deadly failed attack on Karamga Island last week by Boko Haram militants. The governor of Niger's Diffa region ordered the evacuations of Niger residents of several nearby islands after 74 Nigerian soldiers died defending their military base on Karamga. Dozens of soldiers are still missing. Officials say more than 150 Boko Haram fighters were killed by government forces. The insurgents conducted the surprise attack in motorized canoes at dawn on April 28th. Karamga is a strategic island surrounded by Lake Chad's vast wetlands and waterways that straddle the borders between Niger, Chad, Nigeria, and Cameroon. Violent raids by Nigeria's Boko Haram spilled over into Niger and Cameroon last year, drawing the militaries of five nations in the region to battle the Islamist extremists. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has fired the head of the police and other powerful government agencies weeks before he is to hand over his office to incoming President Muhammadu Buhari. Some analysts say the moves are evidence of last-minute score-settling and patronage appointments by the outgoing administration. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
In the past few weeks, Mr. Jonathan has fired the heads of the police, the National Health Insurance Scheme, and the Ports Authority. He also made two appointments at the Securities and Exchange Commission. But Mr. Jonathan is a lame duck president. Former military ruler Buhari bested him in March's presidential election. Jonathan is slated to step down at the end of May, making him the first president to hand power to an opposition candidate since Nigeria returned to democracy in 1999. Analysts say the appointments are essentially futile. There's not much governing the Jonathan administration can do with just weeks to go. Rather, firing the heads of powerful government organs like the Police and Ports Authority and appointing new people to take their place smacks of patronage politics, they say. Clement Nwankwo is the executive director of the Policy and Legal Advocacy Center in the capital, Abuja.
It's really directed at the specific individuals who angered against or who may have angered him, or he's trying to reward people who have offered some support.
Press releases from the administration announcing the firings did not give any reason for the president's actions. Spokesmen for Mr. Jonathan and Mr. Buhari did not respond to requests for comment. A spokesman for Mr. Jonathan's People's Democratic Party, or PDP, declined to comment. Government officials have been forced out of office by scandals before, but Folarin Badebo Smith, managing director of the Center for Public Policy Alternatives in the commercial capital Lagos, says the changes at these agencies seem retributive.
Up to the point where they were fired, nobody was screaming for the head of the Port Authority, and nobody was demanding that the Inspector General of Police be discharged. So it wasn't some sort of uprising against these people.
Both Mr. Jonathan and his party suffered significant losses in the past election, with the PDP failing to win majorities in Nigeria's House of Representatives and Senate, and winning only a minority of states in gubernatorial elections held 2 weeks later. The PDP is now preparing to spend the next 4 years as an opposition party. University of Ibadan political science professor Adigun Agbaje says Mr. Jonathan may have faced pressure from within his party to shake up agency heads as part of the PDP's long-term strategy.
I think it's a mix of inexperience, partisan pressures from within his party and within his government. And I'm sure, you know, as I said earlier, as time goes on, we learn to do things right.
With weeks to go to Mr. Buhari's inaugurated, Badebo Smith says the new agency heads are probably under pressure not to make too many changes. Disagreements are already roiling the Jonathan and Buhari camps over the governmental transition. This week, a dispute broke out between Mr. Buhari and Mr. Jonathan's parties, with Mr. Buhari's camp saying the incumbent administration is not cooperating with them as Nigeria comes closer to the May 29th change in power. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, a conference on fighting wildlife crime in Africa wrapped up yesterday in Congo, Brazzaville. It brought together regional and international stakeholders to develop an African-led strategy and action plan to combat the illegal trade of Africa's natural resources. Charlie Fauci is the Vice President of Conservation for the African Wildlife Foundation. He was also one of the participants of the conference. He spoke with me about the impact wildlife crime is having on the continent and why Africans need to implement their own strategies to stop it.
Africa has always been attached with wildlife. Wildlife is part of our heritage. And the killing of the wildlife is like Africa is losing its heritage. No part of the world has wildlife like Africa. Now we are already suffering the effect of climate change. Tomorrow we are also going to suffer the diminishing of wildlife.
Now this conference, it focused on an Africa-wide strategy with Africans themselves being able to implement these action plans. So what types of strategies were developed at this conference this week that Africa can implement?
This conference was very important. It was the first time that all African countries was coming together to develop a wildlife strategy under African Union. Before, you didn't have strategy for West Africa, Central Africa, East Africa, and we were the first time. And this time, Africa decided to put the strategy in different levels. You have the political action, you have the national action, and you have local action. And this was very important, with clear commitment. And the fact that all the countries are coming together to address this issue and to put it in their agenda is something very important. And I think this may be a turning point for wildlife in Africa.
Will Africa have the resources to be able to implement the strategies?
The European Union, many donors were also present to the conference and decided to support the strategy. You have European Union, for example, you have USAID, you have other countries. They decided to help Africa during this fight against the Indian wildlife crime. And I think we are still moving forward. The study is finalized. The action plan is also undergoing. And I think very soon they have to put a dollar in front of any action.
Also at the conference on Wednesday, something very significant occurred, and that was the burning of 5 tons of ivory. Can you tell us about that?
This is a very big signal. You know, during the last month, we have this happened in different countries, in Kenya, in Ethiopia, in other countries, and now it is now in Congo, Brazzaville. You know, Congo, you have, since the decade, we lost almost 62% of forest elephant. And when you say forest elephant, of course, it is Congo Basin. You have Cameroon, you have Congo, you have Gabon, all those countries. And that ivory is ivory that has been arrested, captured from the poachers, both on the field and at different airports. So this is a very big signal to both in terms of the people who are poaching and also to the buyers, because don't forget that the crime is not only for the poachers. We also want to target people who consume, who buy the ivory. So this was really a big signal to say that only elephants are about ivory.
The African leaders have come together to agree on an action plan. What is the next step in actually implementing these ideas?
For the state, it is important that we enforce the law. There is no impunity at all in the trade of this ivory. Everybody who has been arrested should be jailed. In many countries, you have people who are still having impunity. You can arrest, and you see, in many countries, people from the army are sometimes involved in this. So we want the state to put the law and to enforce the law. On the second point, we put in place a special program where we say stop the killing, stop the trafficking, and stop the trade. So this is something that we should put in place to make sure that that movement is moving forward. The third stage is fighting against poverty. We all agree that part of the reason, not all the reason, part of the reason is also the poverty, because the poaching arrives in the forest where people are very poor. So we need to provide some alternative income to those communities to make sure that they do not destroy what is available for them. Wildlife is part of life. Nobody is happy to keep the wildlife, but sometimes what they see that they need to eat, of course. But now we need to provide alternative resources for them. And the other part is communication. This is where I think we need to put in place communication strategy. All this should go along with good communication, and that is also part of the message.
That was Charlie Fatu, Vice President of Conservation for the African Wildlife Foundation. He spoke with me from Nairobi. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shamari and his guests discussing language influences. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. UN aid agencies warn the growing standoff between protesters and the Burundian government over upcoming presidential elections is raising fears the country is descending into chaos and possible civil war. The discovery of four mass graves in Beni territory in eastern Congo raises questions about the fate of nearly 1,000 people abducted by Ugandan Islamist ADF rebels. And residents on islands of Lake Chad are being evacuated following a deadly failed attack on Karamga Island last week by Boko Haram militants. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, and happy and excited Friday, Sunny.
Happy, excited Friday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are focusing on what else but the so-called fight of the century.
Kim, it's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moweta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sunny.
Nnamdi, Saturday night at the MGM Grand Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, the fight everyone has been waiting for. Floyd Mayweather versus Manny Pacquiao. They're billing it as the fight of the century. Let's begin with the venue, Nnamdi. MGM Grand, you've been there ringside, and you're going to be there again ringside Saturday night. We'll talk about that. But first, Nnamdi, have you ever gotten the sense that such a fight has attracted so much attention and publicity at the MGM Grand?
Sonny, never. I mean, even what we're losing in terms of the ticket prices is just insane, you know. I mean, it's just hotel rooms. That's why it's billed the billion-dollar weekend, you know, because the money on the table is just unbelievable.
Now, this is expected to be the highest-grossing fight in history, Nnamdi. It seems like the amounts just keep going up and up and up. Can it go $500 million?
Half a billion, definitely, easily, because the demand for the tickets, just mind you, Sonny, 500 tickets sold out in 60 seconds. I mean, come on. And if you have the money, you may not be able to go in. So it's just the records are just been shattered everywhere, you know, and we don't know what's going to happen come Saturday night.
Nnamdi, getting back to the tickets, has there been a secondary market for these tickets in terms of scalping and going to the high rollers?
Yes, Sonny, if you remember in the beginning, when we started talking about scaling the house, we looked at secondary market. The face value for the tickets, the highest ticket is $7,500 for ringside. Nosebleed is $1,500. You cannot even find that. The going price for ringside as of Friday morning, Sonny, is $130,000. If we're talking about nosebleed is when you go way, way up on the last row. That's 10 grand, man. So what we see here is the brokers reselling the tickets. Two things can happen, Sonny. The brokers may end up eating those tickets, because the public may say, hey, why do we have to pay this much to see this fight? We can pull friends together and spend $100 and, you know, watch this fight. I mean, this closed circuit alone, Sonny, closed circuit is $150 to go into closed circuit. Imagine you're taking your girlfriend or your wife to the closed circuit. That's $300 right there. You're not talking about what you're going to eat or what you're going to drink. So it's a very expensive weekend, expensive fight.
The people that'll be ringside, though, Namdi, aren't they going to be the casino high rollers, people that the casino is trying to woo, you know, play the slot machines, blackjack, all that kind of thing?
Well, Sonny, the tables alone will bring in between $60 and $80 million. And when the casinos give away these tickets to the high rollers, they expect them to be at the table from a Friday afternoon. A guy buying a $100 ticket is not going to be at the table to spend $300,000 or $400,000 playing the blackjack. He's going to be at a slot machine, you know, which would not add up for the casino. So the casinos have the big boys flying in from Hollywood, the big boys flying in from China, from Philippines, from Europe. They come in to gamble.
Namdi, let's talk about the international aspects of this fight. We have Floyd Mayweather. He's been a prize fighter for about 20 years, fighting this Filipino star, Pacquiao. What about the Asian market, Namdi? How big is that in driving the gross, the record-breaking gross we're going to have for this fight?
Oh, that's a major market, Sonny. We have junket of gamblers coming in from China, from the Philippines, from Singapore. All these countries, you have big rollers coming in. And when these rollers come in, they come in to bet on Manny Pacquiao. They are Manny Pacquiao fans. And they come in big, big numbers. And that's why you see when they go to Macau to do fights, the same group come out, you know. So this is where the casinos expect to make a killing.
Manny Pacquiao, known for his aggressive nature in the ring, Namdi. I know you did point out a few problems he had in his training camp with leg cramps. Overall, how do you see his conditioning for this mega bout?
His condition is okay, but Sonny, I mean, for the fact that I live here, he trained here, and I'm able to see him at the gym, able to see him running, I don't think he's 100%. But don't forget, Sonny, in Mayweather's corner, we have Alex Ariza. Alex Ariza was the strength coach for Manny Pacquiao for many years, and he was recently fired by Freddie Roach. Where is Alex Ariza now? Alex Ariza is in camp with Floyd Mayweather.
He's got some inside information.
Oh, come on, son. It's like your girlfriend, you know, hanging out with your rival, man. You know what's going to happen. She's got your numbers, man. You better be shaking in your boots, bro.
Namdi, tactically, do you see Pac-Man maybe changing things up at this stage? Would he do something radical in the ring on Saturday night to beat Mayweather?
Yes, in the process, he'll get knocked out, Sonny. He must be the ring general. Being the ring general means you must cut off the ring. Because expect Floyd Mayweather to move in the early part of the fight. Expect Floyd Mayweather to jab. Expect him to lateral movement. So if Manny is unable to cut off the ring and pressure Floyd Mayweather, then he stands a chance of just running into a big right hand, and that may be the end of the fight.
Namdi, I know you've told our VOA boxing fans over the years that Mayweather has a unique ability to adapt during a fight and make changes. What about the Pac-Man in that regard?
It's going to be hard for the Pac-Man to make changes and adjust. Not every fighter can adjust. Most fighters find it hard to just stay in one gear. Pac-Man's style is he will just jump all over you, throwing wild hooks, and he's a southpaw. Hoping that you're going to fall right into his left, which is his power punch. And if you walk into his power punch, which is the left, you're going to be dropped. But you fighting him as his southpaw, you're able to put the jab in his body, break down his body, run your combination. I'm talking about Mayweather now. Run your combination. Set up the big right hand. If Mayweather is able to land the big right hand from the beginning of the fight, I don't see Pac-Man hanging in at all.
Do you see Mayweather using the early rounds, Namdi, to maybe take measure of Pacquiao and what he's got coming in terms of the arsenal?
Sonny, the early rounds for Manny Mayweather is what we call banking. make sure to steal the rounds. Don't do too much. Steal the rounds. Put the money in the bag. And then step it up from the seventh round upwards, you know, because by then the man is frustrated, chasing you all over the ring. You're making him miss. He can't catch you. He's all frustrated. In the meantime, you drop in the right hand once a while, once a while. You're tagging him with your left jab. You're breaking down the body. And then 7, 8, 9, 10 rounds, you up it, you step it up. And that's when the bread and butter is a big right hand. And once that's landing, Pac-Man is in deep trouble.
Do you see this fight going the distance, Namdi, the full 12 rounds?
It depends on how Mayweather reads the fight. If he believes he wants to entertain the fight fans, he decides to catch a Pac-Man coming in. He will end with a spectacular knockout. I expect a masterful performance from Floyd Mayweather. But if he sees that he's unable to solve this problem with Manny Pacquiao all over him, he can win a boring 12-round decision, and all those cats that paid $130,000 to sit ringside and see watch Mayweather get knocked out, they'll be really, really pissed off. I mean, $10,000 being the rafter, you see a guy running around the ring and the other guy is chasing him. I mean, cats would not be happy at all.
Namdi, in the build-up to this fight, it seemed like Mayweather controlled a lot of the contractual arrangements. This fight is being billed as Mayweather-Pacquiao. In other words, the Pac-Man's name isn't first, and I think Mayweather will enter the ring second on Saturday night with the Pac-Man starting it off. What about a rematch, Namdi? Is that written into the contract that there will be a rematch should Mayweather suffer his first professional loss?
There's no rematch clause here, but that does not mean at the end of it Saturday night there won't be talk of a rematch. What we will see happen if there's a rematch, if the referee fumbles. Like I said this in the beginning, that I like to see the referee fumble, you know, so that we can get one or two more out of this guy, because this is huge, Sonny. This is major, you know. So no talk of rematch right now. We'll talk about rematch after we analyze what happened Saturday night.
Namdi, can you comment on the judges for this mega bout?
Reputable guys. None of these dubious G's that were once ringside judges. I mean, this is a fight where the whole world was all killed in and watching. So you don't want an incompetent guy coming to be the judge. So guys that are in place to do this job, they're all highly respected by both camps.
Namdi, there is some uncertainty surrounding what happens to Floyd Mayweather after this fight. His father, Floyd Mayweather Sr., is saying he wants his son to retire. He's quoted as saying, "I hope he walks away after this fight. This is a gambler's game, and I don't think Floyd should be gambling too much." Your reaction?
I think he still can do it. We just have to see how he will perform Saturday night. I still believe with a masterful performance Saturday night, he can take any of the welterweights out there. There's no point for him to even move up to the super welterweight or the middleweight class. American is there. A couple of young cats he can destroy in 10 rounds, you know. So there's no, the money is good, Sonny. Why step away from the table when you have all this crazy paper loaded in front of you? His dad is just talking, man. No retirement for Floyd Mayweather at all.
Thanks, Namdi. And have a great time Saturday night when you're ringside at the MGM Grand in Vegas for Mayweather Pacquiao. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a great weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays like today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, Eritrea is on the top of the list of governments censoring journalists, while Ethiopia is number 4. And Kenyan youths learn how to tell stories of people in their communities through photography. First, here's Rocky Dayuni of Ghana with Africa Reggae Fever.
Kosi, Sielela, Tina, lusapho lwayo. African reggae fever, catch it, catch it. There will be no cure when you get it. Hey, you Mr. DJ, play it, spread it. It is the common man's time now to make it. This one is for the rockers from Accra to Kingston. It is the common man's time now to make it. People all over the nation, hope you have a minute to listen to what I have to say. Redemption through music, my only intention, bringing hope to places where the leaders laugh and play. From Accra to Soweto, all I hear is more fire. Youth in the ghetto now desire more fire. Music from the radio, don't take them no higher. It's too late, none of them can stop us now. African reggae fever, catch it, catch it. There will be no cure when you get it. Hey, you Mr. DJ, play it, spread it. It is the common man's time now to make it. From Accra down to Lagos to Addis Ababa. It is the common man's time now to make it. In unity, so gather, don't scatter, fulfill the Bible prophecy. Out of many, come together as one. They've gone down all our heroes in a cold-blooded murder. Try to stop this movement from going much further. Jah Jah give us power to cross every border. Hey DJ, press rewind and come again. African reggae fever, catch it, catch it. There will be no cure when you get it. Hey, you Mr. DJ, play it, spread it. It is the common man's time now to make it. This one is for the rockets from Accra to Kingston. It is the common man's time now to make it. It is the common man's time now to make it. Pay attention, my people, all across the nation. Hope you have a minute to listen to what I say. Where you gonna run? Where you gonna hide? Where you gonna go when the music comes for you? Hey, youth of Congo,
catch it, catch it.
Hey, you youth of Liberia,
Africa.
Hey, you youth of Cote d'Ivoire,
catch it, catch it.
Hey, you youth of Sierra Leone, Zimbabwe,
catch it, catch it.
Hey, you youth of Ethiopia,
Africa.
Hey, you youth of South Africa,
catch it, catch it.
Hey, you youth of Africa,
Africa.
Yes, you know,
catch it, catch it.
A new feeling, a new time, a new vibration.
Rocky Dayuni with Africa Reggae Fever. Well, Eritrea is on top of the list of governments censoring journalists, and Ethiopia is number 4. The Committee to Protect Journalists recently reported on the 10 countries where censorship is the worst in the world. In other top 10 countries, China has jailed 44 journalists, and Iran uses mass and arbitrary arrest to stifle free speech. Daniela Schreier reports from New York for VOA.
Being jailed is what happens to journalists in the 10 countries cited in the CPJ report. China is the report's leading jailer, with 44 journalists behind bars. And the CPJ cites Iran as using mass and arbitrary detention to silence dissent or force exile. With 200 journalists worldwide jailed this year alone, Courtney Ratch of CPJ says it's a perilous time to report.
The past 3 years have been the most dangerous on record for journalists, with record numbers of killings, of imprisonment, and based on CPJ's assistance data, more than 400 journalists who have been forced into exile over the past 5 years.
Internet censorship is a key weapon to stifle criticism. In North Korea, only the political elite have access. In Cuba, bloggers must upload from foreign embassies or hotels to get an unfiltered connection. China's 642 million internet users face what's called the Great Firewall, which blocks dissenting sites and social media.
Censorship is a very powerful tool. I mean, it does restrict information flows. In order to bypass censorship, you often have to have highly technical skills, what tools to use, what techniques, and also how to keep their sources safe, how to keep their broader profiles safe.
The Arab Spring movement led to crackdowns in Eritrea, where the government scrapped plans to provide mobile internet for its citizens. Since the Arab Spring, Saudi Arabia has amended press laws to prevent the publication of materials that contradict Sharia law or undermine public order. State-run media are often the only source of information in the 10 countries on the list. Ratch says the report's publication lets journalists and citizens in these countries know the world is watching and cares. Daniela Schreier, VOA News, New York.
American photographer Lana Wong founded the Shootback Photography Workshop in Nairobi, Kenya in 1997. The project continues to inspire a multitude of teens from one of Africa's largest slums. The youths are taught how to use a camera to tell the stories of people in their communities through photography. VOA's Paul Ndiho has the story.
The images have captured a single moments in time of family bonds and friendship, work and community, love and survival. They were taken by young photographers who participated in a special Shootback project. Lona Wang is the founder of Shootback Initiative.
The great news is that 18 years on, the project is still ongoing under the auspices of the Mathare Youth Sports Association, and eight of my original students are now professional photographers and filmmakers.
The project empowers young people to tell their own stories and express their creative voices through photography, writing, and critical thinking about the world around them. And this has culminated into the publication of Shootback.
Basically, this is a 200-page full-color book filled with writing and photographs taken by my students from Mathare, which is one of the biggest slums in Africa.
Ms. Wong says that her initiative continues to train a new generation of young photographers in Mathare, and that amid all that difficulty, there are great stories of happiness and kids being kids.
The power of this is the true storytelling that came out of this project that was not an outsider's view, but a true insider's perspective on what it's like to live in a Mathare in the Nairobi slums.
Experienced professionals worked closely with the students, providing basic photography training and hands-on instruction both in and out of the classroom. The students were given cameras and told to photograph the communities they live in through their own experiences. Here in Washington, D.C., Shootback has collaborated with the local nonprofit Shout Mouse Publishing House for underheard voices to help bring photography and writing programs to at-risk youth.
I'm really happy to be a part of an event that is giving voice to a community that is all too rarely valued or given the chance to be heard, so both through photography and through writing.
Four books have come out of these collaborations. Mark Hecker is the executive director of Reach Incorporated. His company has worked closely with Shootback to create a book about Washington, D.C.
We introduce young readers to their ABCs through pictures of our city.
A book featuring the works of Kenyan Shootback star photographer Julius Mweru was also on display. Shootback plans to hold more photography camps throughout Nairobi's poor neighborhoods in the coming years. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
10 years ago, the administration of then-President George W. Bush launched the President's Malaria Initiative, or PMI, a $1.2 billion program that aimed to reduce by half deaths from malaria in 15 of the hardest-hit countries in Africa. In 2008, the program was expanded to 19 African countries and the greater Mekong subregion. Over the past decade, working through this initiative, the United States and its partners have helped the target countries make significant strides toward controlling malaria. PMI coordinator Rear Admiral Timothy Zeamer and Global HIV/AIDS coordinator Ambassador Deborah Birx, MD, wrote recently in a blog that the contributions of PMI, together with those of other partners, have dramatically improved coverage of key malaria control interventions, including use of insecticide-treated mosquito nets, indoor residual spraying, accurate diagnosis and prompt treatment, and intermittent preventative treatment of pregnant women. Indeed, according to the World Health Organization, since 2001, malaria deaths have decreased by 47% globally. That's over 4 million lives spared. Most of that progress has taken place since 2005. Still, according to the WHO, in 2013 alone, malaria sickened some 198 million people and killed 584,000 of them. Clearly, more needs to be done. The 2005 President's Malaria Initiative expires at the end of this year, and so the administration of President Barack Obama has formulated a new plan that will take us through 2020. The new strategy begins with the ultimate goal of eliminating malaria everywhere. To get us started over the next 5 years, we will work with our partners to reduce malaria mortality in PMI countries by one-third from today's levels. That means malaria levels 80% lower than they were in 2000. We will also work to reduce the occurrence of malaria within PMI populations by 40% from today's levels and help at least five PMI-supported countries to meet the World Health Organization criteria for pre-elimination. There is no greater joy than knowing children, mothers, and communities are thriving because malaria no longer ravages villages, wrote program coordinators Zeamer and Birx. America's result-driven global health assistance saves and improves lives, reduces long-term health costs, and lays the foundation for sustainable development in the world's poorest countries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover.
You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. On Saturdays, tune in at 4:30 and 17:30 UTC, and on Sundays at 3:30 and 14:30 UTC. Or subscribe to the PCUSA podcast. Just go to our homepage at voanews.com and click on podcasts. Also, we love to hear from you. Send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA on VOA Africa.